Shall we turn to the book of Job? The fascinating story of a man who, for causes unknown to him, suffered the loss of everything. A man who was stripped to just the bare consciousness of his being. Naked I've come into the world, naked I'm going out. And just the bare essence of existence is about what he had been brought to. The loss of all of his possessions, the loss of his family, even the loss of his friends. He's alone. Now, when you are stripped of all of these things that we usually consider sort of necessary for life, when you've lost your health, you don't know if you're going to live another day or not. Everything is gone. What are the questions that you're concerned with at that point? Surely not, what shall I wear to church tonight? That doesn't fit into the issues anymore. The basic questions become questions about what is life? Why am I here? What does the future hold? Is there life after death? Or is this all it is? Is life just this misery, this suffering, this sorrow, this pain, and is that then the end? Next week, we'll be considering a fascinating question that was born out of Job's grief and sorrow. If a man dies, does he go on living? But Job, stripped of these things, coming down to the bare essence of existence, even having lost finally this sense of the greatness of his own personality, wishing that he were dead, cursing the day of his birth. His friends who first came to comfort him, when they hear his complaint, sort of turn against him. They don't really understand fully the things that he is going through. It's awfully hard to fully understand what's going on in another person's life unless you've been there yourself. Paul the Apostle talked about his going through all kinds of afflictions. And yet being comforted by the Lord in these afflictions in order that he might be able to comfort others who were going through similar afflictions. But having gone through the experiences, you then know what the other person is feeling, and you can empathize with him. But Job's friends really didn't understand him. And Job himself didn't understand his circumstances. And so Job is just crying out for some answers, but they don't have the answers he needs. And so we find that the first friend, Eliphaz, declared to Job that a man doesn't suffer unless he's really done something wrong, and the intimation is that Job has to be some kind of a sinner to have suffered as much as he did. Surely this is God's stroke of judgment upon him. Job protests his innocence. And so the second of these friends, whose name was Bildad, speaks up. Chapter 8, verse 1. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite, and he said, "How long will you speak these things? How long shall the words of your mouth be like a strong wind?" Now, Job had accused Eliphaz of being a windbag, not helping him any with his counsel, and so Bildad now turns that around on Job. "How long will your speech be just like a bag of wind?" Doth God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? Is not God fair? Now, the truth is, God is fair. God is just. It is a question that Abraham asked God when God spoke of the fact that they were on their way down to destroy the city of Sodom because of its wickedness. And Abraham said to the Lord, "Shall not the Lord of the earth be just? Would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Would that be fair? What if there are 50 righteous people in that city?" The Lord said, "If there are 50 righteous, I will spare this city." But the issue is, shall not the Lord of the earth be fair? It is something that Satan is constantly challenging in our own minds as we try to understand the circumstances of life. Many times, as things happen to us that we do not understand, Satan makes the subtle suggestion that God isn't really being fair with you. And he is constantly challenging the justice or the fairness of God. It goes back to the Garden of Eden, when God had said to Adam, "Of all of the trees that are in the garden, you may freely eat except the tree in the middle of the garden, and you shall not eat of it, for in the day that you do eat of it, you will surely die." And so Satan came to Eve and said, "Hath God said that you can eat of all the trees?" And she said, "Yes, all but the one in the midst of the garden." And God told us if we ate of that, we would die. And Satan said, "Oh, no, you wouldn't die." But God isn't really fair. He knows that if you should eat of that tree, you will be wise as God. You're going to be like gods. And so he's trying to withhold from you something that is good. This so often is the subtle insinuation of Satan as we look at the law of God, a law that God established for our good, and more we realize how good is the law of God. The things that God was seeking to protect us from. But yet Satan so often points at that very law that God established for your benefit and for your welfare, and he's saying, "Look, God isn't really fair. He's trying to keep you from a good time. God's trying to hold back from you something that is desirable, something that would really enrich and enhance your life." And the idea is that by God putting the restriction there, he's really holding you away from something that you really need or should have. And he's not really fair in doing that because he's keeping you from a good time. When in reality, God is protecting you from destroying yourself. For so many who have taken that path found that it led to destruction. And once on that path, there was no turning back for them. Many have found the path of sin has such a hold once you get involved in it. It's like going downhill, you can't stop. So he makes the assertion, which of course is a correct assertion. God does not pervert judgment. He does not pervert justice. God is absolutely just, absolutely fair. And I rest in that. Because you see, a lot of times people ask me, well, what about those people that are living in Africa who have never heard about Jesus Christ? Would it be fair if God should condemn them forever to punishment in hell, inasmuch as they have never heard of salvation through Jesus Christ? I really don't know what God is going to do with those people. But I do know whatever God does, it will be absolutely fair. Really, though, you ought to be concerned for yourself. You do know. You have heard. Therefore, there is laid upon you that responsibility of having had the light. And if you reject it, then you are condemned. What God will do in all of these cases, I don't know, but I do know that in the book of Revelation, as the judgment of God is coming forth upon the earth, there are voices from the throne of God that say, "Holy and true are thy judgments, O Lord." Does God pervert justice? No. Does he pervert judgment? No. Absolutely fair. In fact, far more fair than we ever dreamed of being. And a lot of times a person imagines himself more fair, more just, more pure than God. But that's a presumption that I wouldn't want to touch. Now he intimates that Job's children were judged by God because of sin. Remember, all 10 of them were killed when a strong wind out of the east collapsed the house in which they were feasting. And so saying, isn't God fair? You know, does God pervert judgment or justice? If your children have sinned against him, and he has cast them away for their transgression. Intimating. Job, your kids weren't innocent. God's wiped them out because of their transgressions. And then he gives him a bit of advice. He said, if you would just seek God and pray to the Almighty, if you were just pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. If you would just seek God and pray to the Almighty, and if you would just be pure and upright, then God would awake. Now, this is an forget it, it's a long word. It is a word that means referring to God in man-like terms, an anthropomorphism, but let that one go. The fact of God awaking for you, that's, you see, the problem with us trying to talk about God or talk about the characteristics of God, all we have to talk with is human language. And human language comes far short when you try to describe God or the characteristics of God, the nature of God, but all we have is human language. We don't have divine language. There's a vocabulary that, you know, we're not familiar with. And you would have to have a much vaster vocabulary than just human vocabulary if you want to talk about God. And so we're bound by human terms, and thus we speak of God with human terms. God would awake for you. Now, it isn't inferring that God is asleep. For the Bible says that God neither slumbers nor sleeps. He that watcheth Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. But several times, David, in writing the Psalms, would say, "Awake, O Lord!" And there are times when we are going through a problem that it, and we've been praying and seeking God and, you know, really searching for the answers, and it seems like God is maybe asleep, in that we don't seem to get any answers, we don't seem to get any response from God. And David, in going through those kind of experiences, would cry, "Awake, O Lord, you know. Wake up, God. I'm in trouble." We sometimes think of God as not being aware, conscious of the experiences that we are, the difficulties that we're going through. So if you were just pure and upright, then God would awake for you and make the habitation of your righteousness prosperous. But Job, there's something wrong. You see, the whole intimation is, hey, if you were all right, if you were pure, then you wouldn't be going through all this stuff. Though your beginnings were small, yet your latter end should greatly increase. For inquire, I pray thee, of the former age. Take a look at history, Job. Learn from history. Prepare thyself to search concerning the fathers. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, because our days upon the earth are a shadow. In other words, we're here too short a time to really learn anything. To really learn, you have to look at history. These forefathers. Now, Job didn't live too long after the flood. And so very aware of the longevity of those people who lived before the flood. How much can you really learn in 100 years? Well, about 1/8 of what you could learn in 800 years, I suppose. And of course, prior to the flood, those fellows lived, you know, almost a millennium. Methuselah, 969 years. That's, you know, so you evidently learn quite a bit in that length of time. You have a lot more time for experience. So listen to the fathers. Go back and study them and learn from history. Shall they not teach thee and tell thee and utter the words out of their heart? Can a rush grow up without mire or mud? Now, the rush is the Egyptian papyrus, and growing on the banks of the Nile River, it requires that mud. Now, during the flood time, the Nile overflowing, there would be pools that would be formed by the flood. And many times the rushes would grow up in these pools, but as soon as the pools dried, the rushes would wither. So he's saying, look, you grew up, you were green, you know, and you look good, but man, now you're withered, you're cut down, because, you know, you lacked a true experience, a relationship with God. And so can the flag, another form river grass actually, grow without water? While it is yet in its greenness and not cut down and withereth before any other herb, when these reeds would grow up in these ponds, they would be the first to wither. As soon as the water receded and the ponds were dry, they would be the first thing to wither away. The other grass that was natural to the desert, you know, they would continue to flourish. But he's using this as it's a proverb, and it's being used against Job, just saying, look, if things were all right, you would have remained, you know, green and strong. And then he accuses Job really of being a hypocrite. So are the paths of all of those who forget God. And the hypocrite's hope shall perish. Man, that's a neat kind of a friend, isn't it? You're miserable. You don't know why you're having all these problems. And these guys come along and they intimate that you're some kind of a horrible sinner. You're a hypocrite. You're hiding it, you know. And you're cut down, man, and there's a reason for it. Whose hope shall be cut off, and whose trust shall be a spider's web. Now, it's a reference to these sort of a spider. You've seen them make these webs that they sort of come down, and they come inside this sort of a web in the window sills where it's a sort of a little tunnel, and the spider goes back in the tunnel and sort of hides back in there and waits, you know, for a tugging on the web out there for the fly or a moth or whatever. But but the web, though it covers the spider, it's a very weak thing. I mean, you can just, you know, put your thumb down and squish the spider. And so it's nothing that you can really rely upon for safety or for strength. And so you're trusting in something that is empty, something that won't really protect you. He shall lean upon his house, but it shall not stand. He shall hold it fast, but it will not endure. He is green before the sun, and his branch shoots forth in his gardens. His roots are wrapped about as a heap, and he sees the place of stone. If he destroys him from his place, then it shall deny him, saying, I've not seen thee. So, Job, you know, you're trusting in vain hopes. You're going to get wiped out, and people will even forget that you ever existed. Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the earth shall others grow. Behold, he said, God will not cast away a perfect man, but neither will he help evildoers. Job, you're declaring that you're innocent. If you were, God wouldn't cast you away. It's obviously God has cast you away. You're seeking God's help, but he won't help evildoers. Till he fill thy mouth with laughing and thy lips with rejoicing, they that hate thee shall be clothed with shame, and the dwelling place of the wicked shall come to naught. That is, if you just get right with God, Job, things are going to be okay. God won't cast you away. He will fill your mouth with laughing, your lips with rejoicing, and those that hate you will be ashamed. Then Job said, I know that it is true. That is that man needs to get right with God. That a right relationship with God is the most important thing in any of our lives. A right relationship with God is a relationship of complete trust, complete commitment. Now, the mistake that Job's friends were making, and Job himself made, was they felt that if a man had a right relationship with God, he wouldn't have any problems or he wouldn't have any trouble. Life would be a bed of roses. But that is not so. That is a false impression that many times people get, and many times we seek to sort of promote that kind of a concept. Just get right with God, man, and everything's going to be okay, you know. Well, that isn't so. I know a lot of people who, when they got right with God, they lost their jobs and they lost their homes, and a lot of things happened to them. God doesn't promise that you're not going to have any problems. He promises he'll be with you and see you through every problem. We are not immune from troubles, but we have a helper, one who is with us in trouble. And nothing happens to me but what God has allowed it to happen. And if God has allowed it to happen, there is a reason and a purpose why He has allowed it. So I learned to commit my ways unto the Lord, to commit my circumstances, my life. I learned to just turn it over and say, well, Lord, it's in your hands. You do what you deem best. And that's the only place where you can rest, when you come to a full commitment. I know it's true. Job said, but how can a man plead his case before God so as to justify himself? That's an interpretation of what the Hebrew says. It's not a literal translation, but an interpretation where he is using a term of the courts. And how should a man be just is literally how can a man plead his cause so as to justify himself with God? If he should contend with God, he cannot answer him one question out of 1,000. If I should try to plead my case with God and God start to cross-examine me, I would be dead. I couldn't answer him one question in 1,000. For God is wise in heart. He is mighty in strength. And who has hardened himself against him and hath prospered? No one. Let me tell you this. If you harden your heart against God, and many people have, but no one has hardened their heart against God and prospered. Woe unto him who strives with his maker. If you're fighting with God, you're fighting a losing battle. Because if you win, then you've really lost. You know, if you're fighting the Holy Spirit that is seeking to draw you to Jesus Christ, and you're fighting this battle against the Spirit speaking to your heart, you're resisting God. If you win that fight, then you are lost. Woe to him who strives with his maker. God is right. You cannot harden your heart against God and prosper. And then he speaks of his observations of God's power. He removeth the mountains, and they know not, which overturneth them in his anger. He shaketh the earth out of her place, and the pillars thereof tremble. The tremendous earthquakes that are so common over there in the Middle East. He commands the sun, and it rises not, and he seals up the stars. That is, takes them into a black nebulae. Which alone spreads out the heavens and treads upon the waves of the sea. Which makes Arcturus, Orion, and the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. So the God who created the universe, the God who reigns over his creation. Which doeth great things past finding out, yea, wonders without number. But yet he goes by me and I can't see him. The problem is God is invisible. I see his works. I see his power manifested in nature. And yet I can't see him. And then he goes on to say, he passes on also, but I perceive him not. This is probably a throwback at this first guy that was telling Job about his vision, you know, in the night. He had deep sleep and fear and trembling. The spirit passed before my face, you know, and it stood still and it spoke to me and so forth. Said, shall mortal man be more just than his God? And so he's probably a throwback to this speech that Eliphaz made. And that is, I can't see him and, you know, I don't perceive him. Behold, he takes away, and who can stop him? Here is the declaration of this awesome sovereignty of God over his creation. And you have to just give this to God. He can do what he pleases. And who am I to stop him? God is sovereign. Now that would be terrifying to me, except I know that God is love. And to just say, well, God is sovereign, he rules, he does what he wants, man, that could just scare me. But to know that he loves me, then I can handle it. I can submit to love. If he takes away, who can hinder him? And who will say unto him, what doest thou? Paul, in talking of this sovereignty of God, gives us the picture of a potter working with a bit of clay. And he said, hath not the potter the power over that clay to make whatever kind of vessel that he wants? And who is the clay to say unto the potter, to the potter, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? The potter has that power over the clay, the sovereignty of God over my life. And really, I have no real right to question what God might be doing. What are you doing, God? Yet I do. I don't have any right to, but I do. If God will not withdraw his anger, the proud helpers do stoop under him. In other words, the strongest of men cannot withstand God. How much less shall I answer him and choose out my words to reason with him? Who am I? You know, the strongest fall before him. Who am I? Whom, though I were righteous, yet I would not answer, but would just make my plea unto the judge. I wouldn't try and justify myself before God. Even if I were righteous, I wouldn't try and declare that. I'd just make my plea, God have mercy. And that's the best plea you can make anyhow. Don't, when you come to God, try to come to God on the basis of, well, Lord, I've been doing this and I've been doing that wonderful thing. And Lord, you know, I've been handling myself pretty well of late. And so, like the Pharisee that Jesus spoke about, Lord, I thank you. I'm not like these other people out here. I pay my tithes and I do all the right things. I'm not an extortioner or whatever. And the poor publican wouldn't even lift his head towards heaven, but just smote on his breast and, oh God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And he said he went away justified. Job is saying that's the position I'd take. I wouldn't try and claim my righteousness before God. I'd just make my plea. Guilty, have mercy, your honor. If I had called and he had answered me, yet would I not believe that he had hearkened unto my voice. I know people like that. If they pray and God answers, then they attribute it to something else. Well, it's just, you know, it would have happened anyhow. It was just coincidence, and it just so happened that, you know, I happened to pray at that time, but, you know, they don't want to give God anything. For he breaketh me with a tempest, and he multiplies my wounds without cause. In other words, Job is saying, I don't deserve this. I'm innocent. And these wounds, and it would seem that Job's physical condition was getting worse, if such a thing be possible. He's multiplying it, and without cause. He will not allow me to take my breath, but he fills it with bitterness. If I speak of strength, oh, he is so strong. If I speak of judgment, who will even set the time for me to plead my case? If I justify myself, my own mouth will condemn me. If I say I am perfect, it will prove me to be perverse. And if I were perfect, yet would I not know my soul, I would despise my life. If I really, you know, thought I was perfect, I don't know my own heart. I don't know what's in my own heart. So this one thing, therefore, I said it, he destroyeth the perfect and the wicked. In other words, God allows the rain to fall on the just and on the unjust. Job is protesting that what he is experiencing, he does not really believe that he has done things that deserve this kind of judgment. That God destroys the perfect man and the unjust man alike. If the scourge slays suddenly, he will laugh at the trial of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covereth the faces of the judges thereof. If not, where and who is he? So, he is speaking about the earth being turned over to the wicked people, and of course, this is so true. The powers of wickedness and the judges and the perversion of judgment. It was terrible in the East, the bribery of the judges and all. It's terrible in the West. Now my days are swifter than a post. They flee away, they see no good. A post is one of these messengers. He'd ride the horse, you know. They carry the messages from the kings. There was a proverb, there is nothing swifter than the post. But Job is saying that my life, my days are going by swifter than a post. They flee away and they see no good. They are passed away as the swift ships, as the eagle that hastens to the prey. And if I say I will forget my complaint, I will leave off my heaviness and comfort myself, I am afraid of all my sorrows, and I know that thou wilt not hold me innocent. If I am wicked, why then labor I in vain? Why am I trying so hard if I'm wicked? Why am I trying to do the right thing? If I wash myself with snow water and make my hands ever so clean, yet shalt thou plunge me in the ditch and my own clothes will abhor me. If I were just came out sparkling clean, you friends of mine would throw me in the mud and, you know. For he is not a man as I am that I should answer him. You don't deal with God as you deal with man. He's not a man. He is God. And you can't answer him as you would a man. And there's no way that I can come together with God in judgment. Neither is there any daysman between us that he might lay his hand upon us both. And so the dilemma that Job sees, the greatness of God, the sovereignty of God, the awesomeness of the eternal, infinite God, and hey, I am nothing. My days are passing away. I'm weak. I'm nothing. Therefore, how can I possibly deal with this infinite, eternal God and try to justify myself before him? There's just nothing I can do. the gulf or the gap between me and God is so great that I'm helpless. The only solution that Job could see was for an arbiter, a daysman, one who could stand between man and God, who could touch them both. And that's exactly what Jesus Christ is. For there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man, Christ Jesus, who was in the form of God and thought it not robbery to be equal with God. Thus he touched God, and yet he humbled himself, emptied himself, and came in the likeness of man in a body of flesh. And so he touched men. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, but the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father. That which was from the beginning, which we have seen, which we have gazed upon, which we have handled of the Word of life, for that Word was manifested. And so Jesus is the answer to the cry of Job for the daysman, one that could stand between God and man, laying his hand on both and thus bringing man before God. And so Job just cries, let him take his rod away from me, and let not his fear terrify me. Then would I speak and not fear him, but it is just not so with me. I am terrified. I don't know what's going on. I'm terrified. Now, Job in chapter 10 is offering again his complaint to God, even as he started out with a complaint of why was I born and so forth. Now he turns to God. It's as though his friends are not there, but he just again pours out his soul and his complaint unto God. My soul, he said, is weary of life. I will leave my complaint upon myself. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say unto God, do not condemn me. Show me wherefore thou contendest with me. Show me, Lord, what I've done. Show me where I'm wrong. Show me what is the reason why all of this calamity has happened to me. Don't just leave me in the dark, but show me, Lord, why you seem to be against me. Job wanted it. Well, the Bible says he was a perfect and upright man. He loved good, he hated evil. And now all of this misery has come upon him and he doesn't understand it. And so his plea, Lord, you know, just show me where I've gone wrong. Is it good unto thee that you should oppress and that you should despise the work of your hands and shine upon the counsel of the wicked? Lord, does this please you that, you know, you should just turn against me? Do you have eyes of flesh? That is, do you see as man sees? Are your days as the days of man? Are your years as man's days? That you would inquire of my iniquity and search after my sin? You know that I am not wicked. Job was not a wicked man. And he is protesting. Now his friends keep trying to lay this guilt trip on him. They keep intimating that he is wicked, that he is hiding his sin, that he's a hypocrite, that somehow he's covering it. He may look good on the outside, but God knows, man, and he's, you know, got your number. But Job is protesting his innocence here before the Lord. You know that I am not wicked, and there is none that can deliver out of your hand. Your hands have made me. And they fashion me together round about. And yet, you're destroying me. Remember, I beseech thee, that you have made me as the clay, and will you bring me to the dust again? God, you've created me. You've made me out of the dust. Are you going to bring me back into the dust? Have you not poured me out as milk and curdled me like cheese, molded me into the cheese and so forth? The curdled like milk, the idea is the seed that was planted, and then within the womb it formed into the child, into the fetus, and into the life. Thou hast clothed me with skin and flesh. You form me like the cheese, then you put the skin around my flesh. And then you have fenced me with bones and sinews, the foundation, the bones and the sinews. Thou hast grafted me life and favor, granted me rather, life and favor, and thy visitation hath preserved my spirit. And these things hast thou hid in thine heart, and I know that this is with thee. So, Lord, I am your creation. You formed me. You made me what I am. And if I sin, then you mark me, and you will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I be wicked, woe unto me. And if I be righteous, yet will I not lift up my head, for I am full of confusion. Therefore, look upon my affliction. So Job is, again, just, it's pitiful. As he's pouring out his soul, he is confused. He cannot understand the circumstances of his life. He cannot understand why, when he has sought to serve the Lord, that he should have all of this misery. We cannot always understand why God brings certain trials upon us, why we go through certain experiences. We also have experienced the confusion of Job. But in those times, we should learn to trust. Just trust God. We don't understand what's going on. And what God so often says is, just trust me. I don't like that advice. I want to know. I want to understand. And when the Lord just says, trust me, I get frustrated. I know I should trust him. I know I have to trust him. I know I don't have anything else but to trust him. And ultimately, he brings me to that. Ultimately, after all my kicking and screaming and complaining, I am brought to the place where, Lord, I just have to trust. You know what you're doing. I am yours. You created me. He said, if I am wicked, woe unto me. If I am righteous, I'm not going to lift up my head because I'm full of confusion. For it in my affliction, it increases. You hunt me as a fierce lion. And again, you show thyself marvelous upon me. You renew thy witness against me, and you increase your indignation upon me. Changes and war are against me. Wherefore then hast thou brought me forth out of the womb? Now again, remember, why was I born? Why didn't I die? And so again, God, why did you allow me to be born? Oh, that I had died, and no eye had seen me. Oh, that there would have been just a stillborn. Are not my days few? And Lord, just please leave me alone, that I may have just a little comfort. Before I go where I'm not going to return, from where I will not return. To the land of darkness, to the shadow of death. Lord, I'd like just a few days of comfort before I die. A land of darkness as darkness itself, and the shadow of death without any order, where the light is as darkness. So this gloom of Job, he's going through this misery. His friends are not really helping him to understand. In fact, they're only bringing greater confusion in their endeavors to help. So the third of the fellows picks it up against Job. And in chapter 11, Zophar's discourse, and then in the next three chapters, Job's response to Zophar. In order that we might keep them all together, we'll take four chapters next week as we look at Zophar and then Job's response unto him. So through chapter 14 for next week. In a interesting sort of way, the book of Job brings comfort to many people. Because though we feel that we have it bad, when you read about Job, man, I haven't had it half bad. It's the story that, again, brings us to the very basics, causes us to look at the basic issues of life. When you get rid of all of the fluff and whipped cream and junk, what's left? You know, where is the real substance to life? What is life all about? Why am I here? Is there any future? Is there any life after death? And what should I be living for? And we'll be looking at these issues as we move along in Job. May the Lord bless you. May His hand be upon you, strengthening, guiding, keeping, as you walk in His love and as you experience His Spirit working in and through your life this week. May God use you, make you His witness, and prosper you in your ways. In Jesus' name.